You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of May 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Cordelia Lynch.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's news agenda with our Hong Kong Bureau Chief, Aisha Spears. Aisha, what have you got in store for us?
We're going to talk about corruption in Hong Kong, a recent advance in local LGBT rights, and a giant defaced duck.
Thanks very much, Aisha. In a culture where coming out number one is so important, we head to South Korea to discuss a growing scandal that is gripping the nation.
We also look at a new success in fiction, Amish protagonists, and speak to an author who tries to explain why chaste romance has now so much appeal in literature.
I think many readers in contemporary, fast-paced, modern societies find something appealing about this subculture that they perceive as moving at a slower pace than their own.
Plus, all week we've been covering that singing contest known as Eurovision, but it's not only camp outfits and even camper melodies. Today we discuss the politics behind the event.
All that, plus we play some music too and get a review of this morning's Italian front pages. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So a very busy 60 minutes coming up ahead, but before all that, let's get a check of the latest world news headlines with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Nigeria's president has declared a state of emergency in three states following a series of attacks by Islamist militants. Boko Haram have been blamed for most of the attacks, which have killed around 2,000 people since 2010. Goodluck Jonathan says he's sending more troops to the states of Borno, Adamawa and Yobe.
The chief of defense staff has been directed to immediately deploy more troops to these states for more effective internal security operations. The troops and other security agencies involved in these operations have orders to take all necessary actions within the ambit of their rules of engagement to put an end to the impunity of insurgents and terrorists.
A UN report on North Korea's nuclear weapons program says it's been significantly delayed by increasingly tough financial sanctions, an arms embargo, and other international restrictions on trade. In the report to the UN Security Council's North Korea Sanctions Committee, a panel of experts also recommended sanctioning three North Korean entities and 12 individuals. Pyongyang is under UN, US, European Union and other sanctions, including a UN ban on all arms exports because of its nuclear weapons program. Luxembourg has agreed to end the secrecy surrounding the country's banking industry. It's agreed a deal with other EU finance ministers to create a new system which will share bank account information with Switzerland and four other small European nations. Luxembourg, together with Austria, had opposed moves to tighten the rules which are part of international efforts to crack down on tax evasion. But the country's finance minister, Luc Frieden, says he's now changed his mind.
Luxembourg is willing to take a step forward and to go into the direction of automatic exchange of information, i.e. information between tax administrations, under one very clear condition, that at the end of the day, this taxation is efficient.
Boeing have resumed deliveries of the 787 Dreamliner for the first time since battery fires on two of the aircraft led to it being grounded in January. The company delivered a new Dreamliner to All Nippon Airways on Tuesday. It says it expects to hit its target of delivering more than 60 by the end of the year. Air India, which has six Dreamliners, is to resume flights with them today. Despite the safety scare, India's Civil Aviation Minister Ajit Singh says they'll buy even more of the planes.
First commercial flight, as I said, is on 15th of May. First international flight will start from 22nd of May. Air India is going to get another eight Dreamliners by the end of this year.
A US government watchdog has criticized the Internal Revenue Service for targeting conservative groups. The U.S. Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration said senior IRS leaders had shown poor management of a policy that spun out of control and compromised the tax agency's political impartiality. It also said that the IRS had used inappropriate criteria when it singled out groups for extra scrutiny based on their names. President Obama called the findings intolerable and inexcusable and said he'd direct Treasury Secretary Jack Lew to hold those responsible for the agency's actions accountable. The FBI has begun a criminal investigation of the matter. MPs and motoring groups in the UK have called on regulators to investigate claims that the major oil companies have been fixing the price of petrol for more than 10 years. The call follows raids by EU antitrust regulators on the offices of BP, Royal Dutch Shell and Norway's Statoil. European Commission officials said that Tuesday's unannounced inspections came amid concerns that the companies may have colluded in reporting distorted prices. The Royal Automobile Club said the claims were worrying news for motorists. A shadow minister said the reports, if true, suggest shocking behaviour in the oil market that should be dealt with strongly. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Bunny, thank you very much. It is 6 minutes past eight here in London.
Hello, you are listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Cordelia Lynch. The time in Jerusalem is at 10.06. It's 9.06 if you are in Rome, 8.06 here in London. It's time now to get ready and set the day's news agenda with the three stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Joining us today from our Hong Kong bureau is our bureau chief there, Aisha Spears. Aisha, thanks very much for coming on the show. You've got a couple stories for us. Let's, though, start with an inquiry into the former chief of the anti-corruption committee there.
Indeed, so it's not good when your anti-corruption agency then has to be investigated by that very anti-corruption agency. Timothy Tong, who was the head of that agency until last year, he started his job as the head of that department in 2007, will be investigated by the Independent Commission Against Corruption. And that's the first time the head of the agency has had to be investigated since the agency started nearly 40 years ago. He's been accused of misusing public funds on entertaining a number of mainland officials, predominantly a few very lavish dinners that were held in 2011, in addition to lots of gifts and expensive receptions that all exceeded the budget allowances he was given. Obviously, there's a bit of concern in Hong Kong at the moment as to how this investigation will take place, seeing as it's the team that he used to lead who will be investigating him. The Department of Justice is also involved. There's a chance that the police might get involved. And it comes at a time that corruption is, again, in the headlines in Hong Kong. It used to be a really big deal in the 70s. That's why they established this independent commission to kind of crack down on that. It really did make a big difference. Hong Kong was very low, had low corruption rates. It and Singapore had the lowest corruption rates in the whole of Asia. But it slipped two places this year. And so this is bad news for people who are worried about that.
And how has it been received there by people?
I think people are just really keen to watch it. The main issue, as across a lot of politics here in Hong Kong, is how this relates to Beijing. Obviously, because Timothy Tong was entertaining mainland officials and he was a representative of the government here, which obviously tied to Beijing, people are concerned that if there's a little bit more corruption creeping into Hong Kong now, it'll start to become more like China. On the global index of the Corruption Perception Index, Hong Kong is currently in 14th position, whereas mainland China is in the 80th position. As we know, corruption is a big complaint in mainland China. Sometimes it's a bigger complaint for citizens than even needing democracy. So I think the main concern is that if we see more corruption in local government here, it's because it's a kind of bleeding over from mainland China.
And this is also happening at the exact same time that Hong Kong is dealing with another bribery scandal, this involving a former senior civil servant by the name of Raphael Hu. He's going to be facing trial later this year, along with the billionaire Kwok brothers. Can you tell us a bit about that bribery scandal as well?
That was a bigger one that came at the end of last year, and people are clearly watching what that will happen. That's dealing with business and government, which is a whole other issue here. A lot of people think that business and government are a little bit too kind of holding hands a little bit too closely here in Hong Kong.
And a pivotal ruling on Monday that allowed transsexuals to marry centred around one particular case.
Indeed. So a lady called, who's just being known as W here in Hong Kong, obviously because she wants to keep her privacy, has changed marriage perceptions in the city. So on Monday, it was ruled that transsexuals will be allowed to marry here in Hong Kong for the first time. It's obviously leading to a lot of criticism from religious groups, and it's caused quite a stir in Hong Kong, which is quite sexually conservative. While it's homosexuality is not illegal here, a lot of people are in the closet. When polls are taken, a lot of people who are gay or who are lesbian or don't want to talk about it. So obviously linking that to transsexuals, it's a big deal. It's been a landmark change here, and it's made news across the world. And I think that there's a lot of people also in China who are looking to see how that will spread to them, if that will change.
And Aisha, one of the judges who voted against the ruling, Patrick Chan, he said that there was no evidence that social attitudes in Hong Kong towards the traditional concept of marriage was changing. Are you getting a sense there on the ground that perhaps Hong Kong residents are starting to open up a bit, starting to accept different definitions of the traditional form of marriage?
I think so. I mean, you would think that, and there's it's a hugely global city, so you've got all sorts of people who are coming in from other parts of the world who have different ideas of what marriage can be and what sexuality can be. But the strange thing is, I asked my colleagues in the Hong Kong office who have grown up here, do you think that this will mean that same-sex marriage eventually will be on the cards? They clearly don't think it's the case. It doesn't seem that this will then bleed over into allowing same-sex marriage here in Hong Kong. It is still very traditional, and it's more because of how traditional families work, and it's an idea of tradition, and that's why that judge said it doesn't seem to be public desire for this to happen. This lady won her case because she said that if they weren't going to recognize her gender, and she'd already changed her gender here on her ID card to be a woman, it meant that the government was preventing her from marrying anyone at all. So that's how she used the kind of, she legally got it by the government, but it doesn't seem that same-sex marriage is really on the cards here.
Shifting onto a topic that's also got a lot of people talking, an entirely different one, centres around a giant rubber duck tourists have been flocking to, and lots of talk about it being affected by pollution there.
Indeed, so it's quite hard to segue to anything to a giant rubber duck, but there is giant rubber duck in Hong Kong Harbour, which has drawn thousands of tourists. It's on Kowloon side, it's just in the harbour there, and a lot of people were there. When I was in Kowloon last weekend, you couldn't even get to the Star Ferry because everyone was taking photos of this huge duck. It arrived a couple of weeks ago, and it's deflated last night. These photos have gone around Hong Kong of this deflated duck. It's a piece by Florence Hoffman, who has been touring this duck around the world since 2007. So a number of bloggers have said that perhaps the duck has deflated because the air pollution is so bad here. But the people who are in charge of the duck exhibition are saying, don't worry, the duck will be back in action. So I guess Hong Kong is a little bit looking forward to their duck being back.
It is quite a funny picture, I have to say. It's a very sad-looking duck on its side with the skyline of Hong Kong behind it. Are people whispering the word sabotage, though, perhaps?
I think they would be if it wasn't so hard to actually get to this duck. I mean, even if it wasn't in the middle of a body of water, it would be hard to even get to the railings alongside of the body of water because so many people were up near there. So I'm not sure anyone sabotaged it, but in some ways I think they should have, because it really has brought a standstill to a part of Kowloon. It's been such a fad. All sorts of stalls around the city have been selling little yellow rubber duckies as if it's a new symbol of Hong Kong. The duck will leave, inflated or not, in 2 weeks' time anyway.
Certainly looks melancholic. Let's hope the mood of the duck improves. Aisha Spears, our Hong Kong Bureau Chief, thank you very much for setting the day's news agenda.
And coming up after this very short break, we'll be finding out about a growing scandal involving South Koreans and accusations of cheating their way to the top.
Ever thought of shaking off those golden handcuffs? Or had a daydream about going solo, striking out, far from the gentle plod of your day job? Then it's time you tuned in to The Entrepreneurs. Every week, we meet the brave, intrepid, sometimes audacious businessmen and women who have done just that.
What we're trying to do is not create a fragrance, but rather evoke something through scents.
It's a show that allows you to learn business nouns by example. So, if you want to learn how to open a thriving organic bakery, patent a savvy invention, set up an artisanal microbrewery, or export a finely crafted product to the world. The Entrepreneurs, the living, working audio Bible. That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Now, in South Korea, a series of scandals have cast a harsh light on the world of South Korean academia. Things came to a head last week as an American examination body suspended all examinations for US university admissions when it emerged candidates on the peninsula had been given copies of exam papers in advance by their tutors.
Now, South Korea is no stranger to accusations of academic fraud. From celebrities to politicians, South Koreans from all walks of life have been accused of, and in some cases, even admitted to cheating to gain academic success. As a matter of fact, these cases have gotten so much attention during the last year or so that even a national Korean newspaper posed the question whether South Koreans are, quote, unusual because of their willingness to cheat.
Well, why is academic fraud in South Korea apparently so prevalent, and what are the pressures that lead people on the peninsula to cheat to get ahead in education? We're here to discuss this is Dr. Jay Kang, lecturer in critical media and cultural studies in the Centre of Korean Studies at SOAS at the University of London. Jay, you've studied in South Korea. How surprised are you by this?
Well, I'm not quite surprised. To be honest, the academic environment in Korea is absolutely competitive. It's hyper-competitive, I would say. And education at top elite universities absolutely gives a surefire edge to job seekers to win the most desired jobs. So this current scandal, it doesn't surprise me very much so.
There have been plenty of high-profile scandals, bogus qualifications, not uncommon in South Korea, amongst, as we said, lawmakers, high-ranking officials. How does this latest scandal rank compared to those?
Well, first of all, I think it is, I'm not quite sure whether South Koreans are unique or unusual because, for example, in Germany earlier this year, education minister resigned after university stripped her of her doctorate for plagiarism. In 2011, defense minister in Germany, too, also quit over plagiarism. So I think it's kind of a global phenomenon about this educational and qualification scandal. But this scandal is quite unique as well in Korea because over the past year, a few lawmakers have been accused of academic plagiarism, too, and along with few celebrities and some star as well. So it is kind of spreading over the nation.
And Dr. Kang, as a Korean myself, I understand there is a lot of pressure, isn't there? And pivotal to this argument or this discussion are the social pressures put on especially young South Koreans and teenagers and students to really come out on top and finish number one really at any cost possible, isn't it?
Precisely. South Korea has the highest suicide rates of teenagers among the OECD countries. It actually shows how hard and difficult to get into the top universities. And then getting into the university actually guarantees their social success. And then it's the social mobilization in South Korea is very much hard as well. So it's a kind of culture of the winner takes all. So young generations are really pressurized, and then the social mobilization caused a problem as well.
And do you think there's an element of a lot of this happening under the radar, lots of unofficial schools that are set up where tutors are providing these exam papers for up to $4,000?
Yeah, $4,000 or even more than that, because there are around 60 private cramming school in Gangnam area. Gangnam is now famous by the size of Song, but it's in that area only there are around 60, 70 SAT private schools there. And then the students are not really feeling guilty to get those papers in advance, and the parents actually play a quite big role. It's also a problem of the social morale and cultural issues as well. But this year is not also the first time. In 2002, GLE exam paper was leaked, and in 2007, about 900 set result to a canceled. So it's been a kind of a mounting problems in South Korea.
So we know that there's the problem. I guess the key thing looking forward, though, is what is being done to address this issue. Are there groups in South Korea that are trying to change the way things have been?
Well, I'm afraid if it is really working very well there, because it's not just about individual youth generational issues, but it's kind of a big social educational system issues as well. Because students would like to get into the top university. For example, Korea is the third largest group of foreign students in the United States, following China and India. So given the populations, this is quite big number. And this is a we should look at why students would like to go into those big university and elite universities with any expenses. So educational ministry and the university tried to change these whole scandals and the problems, but the deep social problems still remains as it is.
And how do you think this will affect their South Korea's international reputation? Because, of course, this is the first time these SATs have been cancelled worldwide.
Well, it would affect us greatly, but it's how the South Koreans would take it. It would be really important because, as I just said, the whole systems are not really working according to the market and education and social mobilization. So South Koreans tried to really construct the fair system of education, but it would take a little bit of time, and then I'm afraid it would affect the South Koreans, the reputations. But it's not only about this national issues, but it's kind of big transnational educational trade and market systems too. So it will take up a little bit of time to clean up as well.
It is indeed a fascinating topic. Dr. Jay Kang from the University of London, thanks very much for joining us here on Midori House. After this very short break, we'll be talking about everyone's favorite topic, romance novels. Now, I'm sure that at one point in our lives, many of us may have come across a romance novel, or perhaps even three, with a cover featuring a bare-chested man reminiscent of Fabio, with a beautiful, skimpily clad temptress and nothing more than a bikini across his arms. Well, this might be the traditional image of romance novels we have come to either love, loathe, or even laugh at, but on the bookshelves of America, a new genre is proving popular. The surprise? It's a hit with evangelical women.
Yes, novels with specifically Amish protagonists have been making a big impact on the publishing market. The Shunning by Beverly Lewism is based around a woman who struggles with the rules that define her community, and that's been a bestseller there. The writer and editor Valerie Weaver-Zerka has been trying to analyse the reasons for the sudden surge of romance novels with Amish characters, and she spoke earlier to Monocle's senior editor Sophie Grove.
So, Valerie, tell me when you first, your first encounter with Amish fiction.
I had seen the books for several years. I live in Pennsylvania, so when I travel the Turnpike or when I go to a store like Walmart, it's just everywhere. And so I had seen them and been interested in them, partly because my grandfather grew up Amish, my family's Mennonite, I'm Mennonite, which is a group that's historically and theologically related to the Amish, so was quite interested in what was happening, and then someone suggested to me that someone really ought to write a book about this and figure out what's going on.
So tell us about the scale of the Amish fiction industry in the U.S.
One of the interesting numbers is how many books emerged last year. There were 85 new Amish romance novels that appeared on the market just in 2012. So that's a new Amish romance novel about every 4 days. And the other interesting number, I think, is the fact that that is a 40-fold increase from just a decade before. So there's been this kind of massive growth in the subgenre just within even the past 4 or 5 years that is just kind of startling and makes you kind of sit up and want to pay attention to what might be going on.
And I wondered, in your book, you look at the rise of this genre outside the Amish community. As you say, you can see these books in Walmart. But I wondered what the literary scene like is within the community? And is there a tradition of reading and a tradition of romance in many senses?
That's an interesting question, and certainly it varies between Amish communities. There would be some Amish communities that would reject reading fiction altogether, that would be kind of suspicious of the novel as perhaps a waste of time or perhaps rousing desires or, you know, interest in the outside world. But there are Amish readers of the novels, and many of the authors say they get letters from Amish people who are loyal readers of their books. I visited a traveling library in Ohio, which has a very high user rate. Most of their patrons are Amish, and these books are being checked out at a quite rapid rate. So they are definitely being read in some Amish communities. There are, of course, Amish people that look at them fairly critically as well. So the opinions are pretty widespread.
A lot of these books have subplots and narratives about redemption. Do you think that the reason why they're so successful is because they appeal to an evangelical readership? Or is this really a very popular genre that's just appealing across the board?
That is an interesting question. You know, most of the novels are kind of located in inspirational fiction, which is read largely by evangelical readers. But I think the appeal can stretch beyond that readership. Danielle Steele, who is kind of the queen of general market romance fiction, has a novel out that is partially set in an Amish community. I haven't read it yet, but it just came out. And I think the genre is spreading beyond just evangelical Christians. I think evangelical Christians are attracted to the kind of moral and sexual purity that they perceive to be the case among the Amish, that the Amish have been able to remain pure of some of the kind of pollutants of modern life that they feel that they themselves and others have gotten entangled in. But I think many readers in contemporary, fast-paced, modern societies find something appealing about this subculture that they perceive as moving at a slower pace than their own.
Do you think, as having Amish heritage yourself, that this represents an ambivalence in American society towards Amish people? Because in some senses, this is really reveling in the kind of pastoral, this very simple life, as you say, people riding ponies and traps around and this lovely Amish mansion in her bonnet. But at the same time, it's slightly voyeuristic and it's slightly sending up the Amish community. What do you think this really says about the relationship between non-Amish and Amish people in America?
I think it points out kind of the conflicting feelings a lot of us have about what one theorist has called hypermodernity, the kind of benefits of kind of a fast-paced, technologically driven society, but then the kind of ambivalence that we have about that as well. You know, the books themselves are quite different from a lot of Amish reality TV shows that are very popular in the United States these days. There are, you know, numerous shows like Breaking Amish and Amish Mafia that are attracting a lot of attention in the United States that I think capitalize on that kind of voyeuristic thrill of looking into this religious subculture that's so private and that might contain these deep, dark secrets. I find Amish romance fiction to be less driven by that kind of voyeuristic desire, I think, than almost, you know, some of the readers express to me the feeling when they read the books, they almost feel like they are traveling back to their own family's past. You know, even if their family had no connection to the Amish, they experience this as somehow representing America's history, that the Amish are very similar to the way that their own grandparents lived. So I'm not sure that that kind of voyeuristic impulse is as operative in this subgenre as it is in Amish reality TV.
And Amish culture is very paternal, and I wondered whether or not there is room for romance in reality. And what's your own experience, and do you think that these books represent anything that really resembles the true romance that happens in Amish communities today?
That's an interesting question, and I spoke with some Amish people and some plain folks who feel like the books really do emphasize the kind of emotional, romantic feelings, you know, the kind of thrill of new love that, of course, is what animates a romance novel to begin with, but who suggested to me that Amish conceptions of romance are slightly different from those of kind of mainstream culture, that there is likely less emphasis on the feelings of love or the rapture of romance, that certainly Amish people fall in love. You know, they are attracted to each other. They marry for a lot of those reasons. But they really tend to emphasize, you know, husbands and wives working together, choosing a spouse based on whether the person is a good worker or not, or whether they will be faithful. You know, that these kinds of conceptions of romance are quite different among many Amish people, and so that perhaps the romance novels aren't able to capture that to their fullest extent.
And Valerie, I almost feel bad asking this slightly raunchy question. Your book is about bonnet ripping, and in its title I wondered, is there much bonnet ripping? How sexy does it get in these books? And is there anything that, you know, paternal Amish fathers might completely disapprove of?
There would be some novels, I think, at kind of the edge or the margins of the genre that or that lie outside of the inspirational romance genre completely, that are kind of sexy Amish novels. There is definitely kind of Amish-themed erotica that is emerging. But the majority of the books, as I read them and spoke with readers, you know, the majority are almost completely kind of chaste spaces. There is very little emphasis on kind of sexual attraction. The protagonist's hair might come out of her covering before she quickly tucks it back in. But there is kissing, there is hugging, but there's very little kind of sexual desire or interactions narrated, even between married couples. You know, the marital bed is even kind of off limits for most of the authors. And that has to do with the conventions of Christian fiction, that there's only certain things that Christian publishers would tolerate their authors kind of writing about. But as a reader, I found very little narration of kind of sexual attraction in the book. So the term bonnet rippers, you know, it's a cute one. It's certainly a nice little play on bodice rippers, but I don't think it accurately describes most of the novels.
That was a definitely interesting interview with Sophie. Have you ever contemplated bonnet ripping?
No, but it's consumed a lot of my thinking for the past 5 minutes.
Well, I'm sure that interview's got you thinking.
Yeah, it has. Clearly a phenomenon, though. Can't be dismissed.
We'll have to get a copy of that book and have a read little later. And that was Valerie Weaver-Zurcher, author of Thrill of Chase, The Allure of Amish Romance Novels, speaking to Monocle, senior editor there, Sophie Grove.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. In the next half hour of the programme, we'll talk about the politics behind the scenes of the Eurovision Song Contest. We'll also take a look at the history of New Zealand's first and only mass-manufactured vehicle, the Trekker, which includes tales of Cold War and passion.
But before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the latest news.
Thanks, Phil. Nigeria's President Jonathan Goodluck has declared a state of emergency in three states following a series of attacks by Islamist militants. They've killed around 2,000 people since 2010. A UN report on North Korea's nuclear weapons program says it's been significantly delayed by increasingly tough financial sanctions, an arms embargo and other international restrictions on trade. Luxembourg has agreed to end the secrecy surrounding the country's banking industry. It's agreed to deal with other EU finance ministers to create a new system which will share bank account information with Switzerland and four other small European nations. Boeing have resumed deliveries of the 787 Dreamliner for the first time since battery fires on two of the aircraft led to it being grounded in January. Air India, which has six Dreamliners, is to resume flights with them today. A US government watchdog has criticised the Internal Revenue Service for targeting conservative groups. The US Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration said senior IRS leaders had shown poor management of a policy that spun out of control. MPs and motoring groups in the UK have called on regulators to investigate claims that the major oil companies have been fixing the price of petrol for more than 10 years. The call follows raids by EU antitrust regulators on the offices of BP, Royal Dutch Shell and Norway's Statoil. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24. And I must apologise to Nigeria's president, who is, of course, Goodluck Jonathan. I was still getting my head round the bonnet ripping, I'm afraid.
It's on your mind, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's really affecting me badly.
I think bonnet ripping has that way on people, as Barney sneaks out out of the studio. You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Cordelia Lynch. Now, for this week's preview of The Entrepreneurs, we head down to New Zealand, where during the 1960s, a group of car assembly line owners took a step that made history. With the help of a then communist regime and a very helpful trade policy environment, they set out to build New Zealand's first and only mass-manufactured vehicle, the Trekka.
It's fascinating, but short history is full of interesting tales of Cold War mentality, entrepreneurial spirit and passion for motor vehicles. Federico Monsalve met with Todd Nile at the studios of Radio New Zealand to unravel the Trekka's inroads into manufacturing history and what appears to be a resurgence of interest in this little curious Jeep with a lot of soul.
Well, we'll start it first. It should start. Need some choke, maybe.
I guess to understand the story of the Trekka, you need to briefly understand, like, it's the politics of New Zealand going back as far as 1940s, where, because we're a trading nation, in order to make sure that we didn't spend more than we earned, the government from the late 1930s onwards brought in this regime of import licensing for everything from Worcester sauce to, you know, prams and pushchairs. And after the Second World War, it particularly started to regulate the motor industry to the point where effectively the government rationed motor vehicles. It decided how many could come in, what types, which models. Where the Trekka came into it, there was quite a small family car firm in Palmerston North. Phil Andrews' family ran it. He had the Skoda franchise. He was looking for a way to build that franchise up. These were cars coming from then communist Czechoslovakia. 1961, he went to Czechoslovakia and he'd suggested to them the idea of an agricultural vehicle, because New Zealand was a big farming country in those days. And from his experience with the Skoda cars, which had a separate body and chassis, he figured out that you could use that mechanical basis to build almost anything that you wanted on top of it.
How did the government react to the fact that there was this character from New Zealand going back and forth to a communist nation smack in the middle of the 50s and the 60s and the 70s?
It was something that the Security Intelligence Service of New Zealand had on their radar. They would occasionally turn up at the factory, interview management about, oh, I know you had so-and-so here. Do you know where they went? Do you know who they were meeting? One of the early directors of the firm was actually invited by the Security Intelligence Service as to whether he would like to, you know, provide information to them on an ongoing basis. They even asked him whether he, because he'd been to the Czech legation in Wellington, whether he could perhaps draw them a floor plan of the building as he remembered it. So there was this, when you look back at it now, almost comical sort of Cold War theme running through this contact. So eventually Phil Andrews managed to persuade the government here to issue import licenses for a certain number of Skodas. He had to have them assembled somewhere. The obvious place was an independent assembly plant in Auckland in Otahuhu. It was a family firm, the Turner family. And there was the entrepreneurial son in the family, Noel Turner, bought the business from Phil Andrews, continued the negotiation with the Czechs. They did design work and eventually produced, at the end of 1966, the Trekka, which was basically a Skoda Octavia chassis and engine, onto which they bolted a New Zealand-designed body.
Nonetheless, by the late 60s, and only a couple of years after the Trekka dreams started rolling off the production line, the sales began to level off. New businesses were quickly hustled overseas, and poorly researched exports were sent to Australia, Indonesia, and various Pacific islands.
Motor Holdings clearly had no idea how to provide support, how to select dealers. And so despite all the effort put in by government, probably only about 50 vehicles ever made it across the Tasman, and the thing just kind of died a death. And this great dream of New Zealand being a significant car exporter faded really by about 1971.
Fast forward to 2013 and the Trekka is making a bit of a comeback. If not in terms of sales, definitely in terms of symbolic currency. As New Zealand starts to look at its design and manufacturing history as an intrinsic part of its larger national identity, the Trek is more than just a curious moment in the island's industrial past.
What, of course, we have now is nostalgia for it, in the same way as nostalgia for Crownland swans and rubbish like that. And it was a time when New Zealand had a sense of identity, I suppose, because we were so insular and so protected from access to the world. And the era of the Trekker was the era of youth bursting out with their own music and their own fashion and surfboards and so on, just echoes their own lost nostalgia for their lost youth. And I think that popularity is there. Also, there's very few of them around now, so they're highly collectible.
I loved it as a kid. When they first appeared in showrooms, I remember looking at them and thinking, wow, it'd be neat to have a New Zealand made car. And so that's why I like it, even though it's as about as ugly as it gets. It's just a little square box.
Neil Tollich is one such collector. I met him in his garage in Auckland's North Shore, where amongst a mind-boggling array of luxury vehicles, including Lamborghinis, Ferraris, old racing cars, sits the humble Trekker.
They're sweet, they're simple. This whole top comes off and it becomes convertible, or you can have a utility top with a tray at the back, you know, cloth straps to hold things together. More and more people are becoming aware, and if one does appear now on auction sites, unless it's just a rust bucket, but if it's anything good, they are snapped up straight away.
When it comes to maintenance and sort of maintaining a car that's old, where do you find parts? Where do you find the person who actually knows how to deal with that particular type of machinery and all that?
Well, remarkably, because these things were made in New Zealand, lots of what were then young apprentice mechanics in the late 60s, early 70s are now people my age who are still mechanics, like my friend who's my mechanic who does a lot more work. He worked on these. He was an apprentice mechanic. He knew them like the back of his hand. So when I pulled up in this, he just laughed his head off. Couldn't believe it. And so in terms of getting them fixed, anybody can do it because they are simple. Parts are less so because the bodies have rusted away, but they are simple parts. There's a guy in South Auckland, young man, who has the most incredible, he has spent years buying old steel presses from England that fabricate panels for cars. Oh, right. So he's got these incredible old monster presses, and he can make a Buick Roadmaster panel, he can make a Trekker panel, he can make a Porsche panel. Do whatever he wants. He's a very clever man. Would you like to go for a ride up the road?
Yeah, sounds great.
I mean, the road's a bit wet, but it's not pouring with rain, so we may as well just take it for a little run and you'll see what it feels like.
Okay. It's got a sort of military look to it, doesn't it?
It does. Well, I think the military bought a few and they took them to Vietnam to use them up in Vietnam during the war, and they took five up, and they all got stuck pretty much straight away in the mud of Vietnam, and even the Viet Cong didn't steal them, they were just hopeless. So no one wanted them.
And to hear the full story of how the Trekker came to be and how they are looked after, tune into this week's Fix It themed edition of The Entrepreneurs. That's at 0600 in Auckland, 1900 hours London time, and 1100 in the morning if you're in San Francisco.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this. Our guilty pleasure on the show, Eurovision. But this time we turn away from the fluff and fancy and talk politics.
In a region typified by change, Istanbul is in the middle of a renaissance of its own. Monocle Films visits the historic city to witness its contemporary metamorphosis.
Battles over the projected identity of Turkey on the landmarks of the city translate into protest. While disagreement over the future exists, pride in the changes is not in short supply.
Istanbul Inspired, a film about change in an ever-changing city on Monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 16:43 in Tokyo, 8:43 here in London. Now today, it's time for the third instalment of our Eurovision series. And we look at the politics involved in Eurovision. Which countries are in and which countries are out this year?
Some countries have already said that they're not taking place in this part in this year's event for different reasons. Well, to tell us more about some of the politics behind the event, we have author of the Eurovision Song Contest, The Official History, John Kennedy O'Connor on the line. John, thanks very much for joining us here on the program. Why on earth would someone not want to participate in Eurovision?
Well, there are many reasons, and many of the countries that are not taking part this year have extreme financial problems in their economy. And as they are, almost all the participants are state-run television companies, they simply don't have the cash to attend. Some who did attend, Cyprus, for example, who've now been knocked out, were so cash-strapped they could only afford to send one singer for the stage. They couldn't even afford to send their backing singers. So it's a cost issue. And also there is then the fear that you might actually win. I don't think Cyprus needed to worry about that, but it is a possibility. And if you win, you have to host, and it's an enormous outlay.
Well, you talk about Cyprus and you instantly, of course, think about Greece and the voting lines. Now, there's often talk about how people will make vote along political lines and this kind of block voting. But in fact, it would seem there simply aren't enough neighbours for that to work for countries. A lot of these votes seem to be along cultural lines. And of course, what's the best song?
You are absolutely right. I mean, this political argument just doesn't stand up to any scrutiny. A lot of people use the example of the ex-Yugoslavians. They say, well, Bosnia votes for Serbia, Serbia votes for Croatia, etc., etc. Now, they may well do that, but they're doing that because they recognize the singer. The song is going to be played on their radio just as much as it is in the host in whichever country it's coming from. And if you actually go to these countries, and we were in Serbia for Eurovision about 4 years ago, these neighbors actually despise each other, quite literally. And 20 years ago, they were trying to kill each other and wipe each other off the planet. But they vote for each other because they recognize the music, and the music is a shared culture, and that's where the voting comes from. And yes, you can never win the contest with neighbor votes. You have to get a broad appeal across all 40 nations if you want to win.
And another country that isn't participating this year is Turkey. Give us a bit of insight as to why they've pulled out.
Well, that's a little bit more complicated. They seem to have sort of taken up their toys and gone away in a huff. They're saying they're very fed up because the voting switched a couple of years ago from being 100% televoting to 50-50 with a jury. And they weren't happy about that. And they're also very unhappy that five countries get to qualify automatically. And that's Germany, Britain, France, Italy, and Spain. And the reason they go straight into the final, not only because they have the biggest viewing figures and you need that audience, but because they finance the EBU, who run the Eurovision network. And so they're given a pass to the final. And the argument that Turkey are putting forward is, well, their songs are no good. And if they had to go into the semifinals, they wouldn't qualify. And that's actually not an unreasonable argument. If you look at what the UK have been sending and coming last virtually every year, there's no way they would have qualified.
Well, you do think about the enormous financial outlay of this, really. Do you think this is a watershed moment in the Eurovision? It seems every year we talk about, you know, is it going to decline in interest? Is it just too difficult economically, really, to give it the platform it once enjoyed?
Yes and no. I don't think Eurovision now will ever die or ever stop. It's gone too far. It's in its 58th year. It would have died out in, you know, the 1980s if that was ever going to happen. But somebody has to put a draw a line in the sand, if you like, and say we can't continue with the excesses that have come. And Swedish television have done that. Now, there's still an audience in the arena of 11,000 people, and that's vast. I mean, the first Eurovision I went to, there were 1,800 in the audience. But it's a third of the size of last year. They've also cut the budget to a third of last year, and they're saying we don't need to spend all this money. And the reason they've done that is to encourage smaller countries to say, you know, don't go away. We can do it on a smaller scale. We can do it more affordable. I mean, spending 40 million euros and 50 million euros like the Russians and the Azeris did is ridiculous, but they can afford to do it. Sweden, Portugal, whatever, they can't.
John, a fascinating insight into the politics behind the Eurovision Song Contest. Thank you very much indeed for speaking to us. That was John Kennedy O'Connor, author of the Eurovision Song Contest, The Official History.
Now, we have much more Eurovision here on Midori House. Our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, spoke to Stoyan Yankolov, the Bulgarian contestant of this year's Eurovision. Yankolov will be competing together with Elitsa Todorova with the song Samo Championi on Thursday's second semi-final.
Stoyan, first of all, tell us a little bit about your song. It's called Samo Championi. It's sang in Bulgarian. What is the meaning of Samo Championi?
Samo Championi, in English, it means only champions, because we put this title because this song is dedicated to the courage and perseverance of athletes and all the other successful people in the world. The song was inspired by their successes and achievements and iron will. And even a mother who was able to raise her children with love, hardship and work also is a champion. Everybody is a champion in the hearts of those who love him or her. That's why we put this title of the song, because the song is very temperamental, dynamic and with a lot of energy.
It is indeed. That's why I love it. And well, let's hear a little bit of the song. And Stoyan, that's a very nice song. And what I can see is that you mix this traditional folkloric music from Bulgaria with modern beats. Do you always do that?
Yes, okay. Actually, our songs with Elitsa that we make in our program, it's not only these songs, every song is different by the other songs from the pop style, because there is happen many things and seems like mini spectacle. Also, we use the basic from our folklore, because we can play it and we have big respect of our folklore. And I think we're successfully mixing with the pop style. We very like the electronic music, R&B, soul, hip-hop, everything. For example, I like to play all kinds of music, all styles, as a drummer, of course.
And Stoyan, just a quick question. Tell me a little bit more about your history on your Eurovision. I have a feeling that this is not your first participation on the show.
First participation, it was 2007 in Helsinki with song Water.
And it was the best place for Bulgaria to date, right? It was the fifth best song on 2007's Eurovision. Are you excited for this year? Do you think it will be even better than the fifth place? Are you going to be the champions?
I cannot guarantee that we will win good place now, because the result always is unpredictable, you know. But we will make the maximum for the quality performance and show our music to the people. This is important.
How popular is Bulgaria with other neighboring countries? Because, you know, sometimes Eurovision is all about the political voting. Some neighboring countries vote for each other. Does this happen with Bulgaria as well?
I want to say this, that many countries take participation in Eurovision from long time. Bulgarian is a country that very young country in Eurovision, you know. And normally, every country has a lobby, and they vote each other, you know. And maybe I hope after some years, Bulgaria also will make many countries in the lobby, and will help with vote each other.
That was Monocle researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco speaking to Stoyan Yankelov, the Bulgarian contestant of this year's Eurovision. You're listening to Midori House with me, Cordelia Lynch, and Phil Han. Well, time now to review this morning's front pages today with an Italian twist. We're joined by David Pleasant. David, hello. And we start with some pretty serious protests happening over the high-speed train building network between Turin and Lyon. A next stage in, you know, an already intense battle over this.
Yeah, it's a very contentious issue. The TAV, Treno Alto Velocità, has caused a lot of controversy and has really kind of garnered support from a huge kind of section of society in that part of Italy. On one side of that section is the kind of extremist environmental protesters. And yesterday they attacked one of the large sites in the Val di Susa, which is a mountain region right by the French border, west of Turin. They threw various missiles, including Molotov cocktails, and locked, there were workers in the site, they actually locked the gates, preventing them from escaping. So really quite a serious attack. The Interior Minister, Angelino Alfano, this morning said that this is a serious attack against the state, and these delinquents were not only could have killed people, but looked like they were trying to kill people. So it looks like the state's really trying to step up.
Well, what are some of the motives behind these attacks? Are they guessing? Because obviously, you know, why are these people so against this high-speed network?
You may well ask. You might think it's quite a benign, perhaps positive program. But actually, the problem is an environmental one. The drilling through the mountains is said to go through deposits of uranium. So there's quite strong fears that the uranium will leak into the water table and perhaps affect thousands of people in that area.
So these are environmental protesters?
They are environmental protesters. This the government and the region has been trying to push through this high-speed link for about 10 years, and it's really going very slowly. So this just raises the question, will this ever go ahead? Because it's been in the news in Italy for a long time, and this just seems to be the latest blow setback for the project.
And could induce some sort of stalemate, really, in the development of it then.
Exactly. Although there's various people within industry and other kind of influential people within Italy that really want to push it through. And as we can see, the building is underway. So I don't think they're going to turn back and stop building. But it's going to be a good few years before we see a connection between Turin and Lyon.
Well, what are some of the editorials in the Italian paper saying? Are they generally behind this move? Are they saying, you know, these are just a bunch of wacko environmental protesters, we should just ignore them and continue building on with this link?
Well, no, actually. I mean, obviously, the in the Corriere della Sera, this is being reported as a violent attack. But the NOTAV campaign has quite a lot of legitimate, you know, backing. If you go to Turin, you'll see NOTAV in lots of the windows of people's apartments, and it regularly gathers support from all sorts of backgrounds. So there are legitimate fears for the environmental consequences of this project.
We talk about pushing through those plans. The government also trying to get to grips with the pension crisis at the moment, which besets a lot of Europe, and would make some of these reforms. Italian pensioners amongst the oldest in Europe in terms of their eligibility.
Exactly, and the opposite of the current state of affairs, where you know, Italy's seen to have quite a good deal for pensioners amongst the youngest in Europe. Yes, as you say, this comes on news that the national debt has reached record levels, something like €2.5 trillion announced today, and the government, as a reaction to that, has said that they want to crack down on the pension crisis as they see it. So the La Repubblica has put quite a helpful table suggesting that by 2020, Italian, to receive your pension, state pension in Italy, you will have to be 70 and 3 months old, precisely, which will make Italian pensioners the oldest in Europe. British pensioners, by comparison, will have to be 68 by that year.
So Enrico Letta, the Prime Minister, has barely been in the job, and this is probably one of his first big hurdles he's facing, isn't it?
It is, and deeply unpopular. I mean, it's hard to overestimate how entrenched the pension system is in Italian society and how dependent people are on it.
And David, just very, very quickly, you have another quite funny but serious story about traffic fines in Italy.
Yes, Il Sole 24 Ore, the financial daily, is reporting that if you have a traffic fine, forget about paying it, because there's no way to recoup that. The Equitalia, the tax and fine collection service, is actually kind of putting on a strike against some of the municipalities that it's receiving traffic fines from.
So the Italians, you can go park wherever you want.
Exactly, in over 6,000 towns. So you've got quite a lot of parking spaces there to choose from.
Exactly. Thanks very much, David. That, unfortunately, is all the time we have for today. Thanks to our producer, Marcus Hippie, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Lily Hess. Our studio manager today was the very capable Alex Funnel. Up next after the news is The Menu, Monocle's food and drinks program hosted by Marcus Hippie. The briefing is back here at midday London time.
I'll be back with Sophie Grove at the same time tomorrow, but for now, from me, Cordelia Lynch.
And from me, Phil Hahn, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.
a Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.